I'm an addict called Vito. Hi, family. I'd like to thank the regional committee, convention committee, for asking me to come here because it's always an honor to be able to serve. I'd like to thank my higher power because without my higher power, none of this would be possible. And I'd like to thank the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. Without people like you, I wouldn't be standing here today. I'm not going to get into a big drug log. I want to qualify for a couple of minutes, but I believe that our message is one of freedom and recovery and not about addiction. So I want to talk about the solutions. But I will qualify for a few moments. I was born in a place called the Bronx. It's the best part of New York City because it's the only borough that has the in front of it. There's no the Brooklyn or the New York or the Queens, the Bronx, because it's a holy ground. It's blessed by addiction. I grew up there. I started using at a very early, young age. I picked up my first drug in 1944. Most people in this room weren't even born. By the time I was 10 years old, I was mainlining heroin, doing what I had to do to support my habit. My whole life was beginning to change, and I had no idea what was happening to me. I remember when I was about 13 years old, me and a couple of my friends were playing poker in the bottom of a tenement. His father was a super there, and we were playing the game, and one of our friends was in the corner playing another game called Russian Roulette. And he blew his brains out in front of us, and the only thing we could feel, we were annoyed, we had to move the game. And I knew that I was different than other people at that point, but I didn't know what was going on. I didn't realize, like I realize today, my feelings were froze from years of using. And I used every day from 1944 to 1956 when I got busted at a gun battle in a place called Orchard Beach. And I took off through these woods trying to get to a place called City Island to pick up the bus to the main part of the Bronx. And I found myself in the middle of the New York City Police Academy summer training grounds. And back then in New York, the rookies used to wear these gray uniforms. And I had 1,000 gray people coming at me. And they put me into a paddy wagon and they brought me downtown to Manhattan for night court. I was arraigned and thrown to a jail called the Tombs overnight. The next morning, I was transported up to Bronx County, and the only nice thing about that facility, I had a beautiful view of Yankee Stadium. But that was the first time that I've ever experienced a thing called withdrawal. And I remember banging my head against the bars, trying to create pain elsewhere in my body than my gut, and the guards coming by and spitting on me because addicts were the lowest thing on earth. And I detoxed in that cell. And you know, as addicts, we have a way of finding enablers. And after 30 days, I was called before the Bronx County District Attorney, and they offered me a deal. If I would leave the state of New York, they'd offer me probation. And I immediately moved across the river to New Jersey. And I got myself a furnished room in a place called Jersey City, Journal Square, where they had the Tubes, which is a subway that runs into Manhattan. And my life didn't change much. I was in New York on a daily basis. In the last 4 years of my using, I don't remember much, except I was living on railroad tracks, under bridges, under people's porches, but it all came to an end on February 14, 1960, in a gutter in a place called Brick Church Station in East Orange, New Jersey. I was laying in that gutter. The snow was falling on me. My skin had turned yellow. And I believe I was dying in that gutter. And you know, lying there and people stepping over me, and many of us in this room know what it feels like to be a nun person or in front of people. And people acted like I didn't even exist. And then somebody finally had some compassion and called an ambulance, and I was taken to a hospital. And when I got there, the doctors wouldn't even touch me because I was covered with lice. And they made the nurses deloused me before they would even treat me. And when they treated me, they found out I was suffering from both infectious and serum hepatitis from dirty living and dirty needles. And they told me I was contagious, So they put me into what was known as an isolation ward. And that's when I met my next enabler, because I was admitted to the hospital on welfare because I had no funds, so I couldn't get a real doctor. I got a half doctor called an intern. And this guy was from Greece, and he would come in on a regular basis and said, the man wants to talk to you, but he can't come in here because you're contagious. But I'm going to offer you a deal. If you would sign these papers, we have a place upstairs where there's people similar to you. Well, in the northeastern part of the United States, in February and March, it's pretty damn cold. So, you know, three hots and a cot sounded pretty good to me, and I didn't know where I was going. And this was before the days of detoxes and rehabs. And when I finally got upstairs, I got very pissed off because I looked around and it was a big, wide-open room lined up with beds, maybe 20, 30 beds in a row, and people sitting there in green gowns. And I said, where am I? And they said, you're in an alcoholic ward. And I said, why am I here with these people? They're sick. They can't stop drinking. But see, I'm not really an addict. I could stop anytime I want. But you got to realize, I just don't want to. And many of us had that denial. Oh, I could stop if I want to, but I don't want to. So I stayed in that facility, and two things in that facility changed my life. One thing is I got very friendly with an old man in there, and I'll use those words cautiously because I'm much older today than he was back then. But when you're in your 20s, they look pretty damn old. And this guy I gravitated to almost like a father figure, because you could rap with him. You want to talk about God, he knew God on a first name basis. You want to talk politics, he knew everything there was about politics. He could solve anything in the world. The other thing that happened to me in that facility, I was forced to attend the meeting every Wednesday night with some people brought in. And I didn't want to be there because when I went to that first meeting, there was a bunch of people coming in and they called themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, what's a bunch of drunks going to do for me? I mean, they got a problem. They can't stop drinking. But I could stop using anytime I wanted to. And I didn't want to be there, but the facility said that I had to go or I had to go out in the street. So I used to come every Wednesday night. And then one day, the old man, my buddy, was being discharged. And we wore these green hospital gowns. And he went into the back room to put his street clothes on. And when he came out, he was a Skid Row bum. And I looked into that man's eyes, and for the first time, something clicked. There was no difference between me and him except our drug of choice. He'd get high on Sneaky Pete or Thunderbird, and I'd get high on anything I get my hands on. And so I started to listen when these people came in with the meeting. And I began to identify beyond the substance. And when it was time for me to go, I was still homeless. I had no place to go. The only thing I had was this meeting list these people gave me. And they told me the magic words. If you come to our meetings, we got coffee and cookies. Now, when you're homeless, that's a big invite. So I showed up that first night. I went to a meeting. When I got in there, they stopped me at the door and says, you're different. You don't belong here. This is a closed meeting for alcoholics only. People like you don't get better. And they took my meeting list from me, and they circled some meetings that were called open meetings, and they said, you could go there, but you better not go because people like you just don't get better. Well, one thing you don't do is tell an addict not to come back. Because I started to show up at these great big open speaker meetings, and when I sat down, everybody moved away from me. Now, you got to realize, this is 1960, and when you'd walk into that fellowship, all the guys had jackets and ties on, very few women, and here I come in with hair down to my butt, garrison belt, razor sharp, boots, and they'd take one look at me and they'd move away. But something was happening in the early 1960s in that fellowship. More and more people like me begin to come in. And you know, they say water seeks its own level. We sort of knew that we belonged together and we sat together. And we shared very deeply with each other, like we stand in front of the church and say, hey, what's happening, man? But we had no ability to share any deeper than that, but we knew we belonged together. And then one day in 1964, in the Vailsburg section of Newark, New Jersey, I was sitting in a meeting of the other fellowship, and somebody came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, and they called me by a nickname I got in that fellowship. They said, "Hey, animal, there's a drug meeting in the back room." Now, I had no idea what a drug meeting was, but myself and the herd of animals, we went back to the back room. And for those of you in this room that can remember the 1960s, we got in that back room, and there was a bunch of people that were different than us street people. They were the love children and the hippies of that generation. And the guys had long hair and clean hair, by the way, which we didn't have. And they had these white T-shirts with peace signs, and the girls had these flowers in their hair and skirts down to their ankles. And what they were telling us is that they came down to San Diego, California, and they were addicted, and they got clean in a place called Narcotics Anonymous. And what they would do is they traveled across the country and crashed in at every commune. And for those of you not old enough to remember the communes in the 60s, they were safe houses for the hippies. And what they would do is go to the other fellowship and rent the back room and have these NA meetings. And they opened up the meeting, and back then, we didn't have much literature. There was an off-color beige book. And they would begin to read. And they opened up the meeting, and they got started, and then they started to share. And I call that the first day of my life, because out of their mouth was coming my thinking. Because up to that time, I thought I was unique, alone, insane, and not another person who thought the way I thought. Now, you got to remember, I had been in recovery 4 years and was not allowed to open my meetings because I was an outsider at those meetings. And they let us locals talk. It was the first time that I shared. And the guys that I sat at those meetings with opened their mouth, and their thinking was coming. My thinking was coming out of their mouth. And I realized from that point on, I was not alone. There were other people just like me. And when these hippies moved on, us locals tried to keep the NA meetings going. But there was laws in New York and New Jersey called Rockefeller laws that if two or more addicts congregated together, you got busted, whether you're using or not. So we would meet in secret, and we tried to keep these meetings going. And we didn't know much about recovery. We were clean, but we didn't know what recovery was. And there were some new people starting to come in from two treatment centers that opened up in Manhattan, Daytop and Phoenix House. And they said, "We know how recovery works. When somebody shares something sick, you gang up on them, and you confront them. The chairs start flying, tables turning over." We didn't know how to do it. But I had kept in contact with one of these hippies that had gone back to San Diego, and I would talk to him on a weekly basis. And he said to me one day, he said, "Vito, why don't you come out to San Diego? We got recovery out here." And I said to him, "Well, that's all fine, but you don't understand. I cannot leave the East Coast. My living is here." And he said to me, "What living, Vito? You don't work." I said, "But you don't understand. Here in New York and Jersey, we got this thing called welfare. And if you're an addict, you're considered that you got a disability, and they send you 2 checks a month. You go to the pool hall, play 9-ball all day long, and part of your money, you got an income." He said, "Don't worry about that. We got welfare in California, too." So I take off, and I get to San Diego in 1964, and I expected this big, great land of Narcotics Anonymous. And when I got there in 64, there was only 2 NA meetings in the city. And I remember the first night I was with the guys, and we were driving up to this meeting up in Mission Hill, a big Catholic church. And we get into the parking lot, and they said, "Vito, don't mention Narcotics Anonymous." I said, "What do you mean, don't mention Narcotics Anonymous? We're going to an NA meeting." He says, "Yeah, but the church thinks we're AA. They don't rent to addicts." That shows you how resourceful the addicts can be. The other meeting we had in East San Diego, our landlords accepted us open-heartedly. It was a Black Panther clubhouse. But those of us who went to NA stuck together like glue. And we talk about doing the steps the NA way. And one of these guys says to me, "Now, I got to tell a story on myself. I'm 5 years clean now, and I don't have a sponsor, because I figured you people are too sick to sponsor me." But the only problem was people were coming in behind me, and they were getting better, and I was still jonesing on a daily basis with 5 years clean. So I figure I better ask myself to ask somebody to sponsor me, because people who had sponsors were getting well. So I asked this guy if he would sponsor me. He says, yeah, they'd all sponsor you. Where are you with the steps? And I looked at him and got very indignant. I said, what do you mean, where am I with the steps? I've heard him read for almost 5 years. I'm done. We know a few people like that today, too. He says, okay, you're done with the steps. He says, tell me about the first step. I said, that's easy. I'm powerless over drugs and my life's become unmanageable. He said, whoa, where does it say drugs in the first step? And I picked it up and says, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction. I said, addiction, drugs, what the hell's the difference? He says, I'll tell you what the difference is. Drugs is that stuff you put in your body. Addiction is that funny looking thing between your ears. I said, you mean me? And he says, yes, the disease of addiction is a disease of attitudes, a disease of negativity, a disease of not wanting to deal with life on life's terms. The getting and using is the final result. You've relapsed long before you picked up. And he says, you've never taken a first step. I said, how can you say I never took a first step? You were on the West Coast, I was on the East Coast, what would you know? He says, anybody that shows up at a meeting and identifies himself as a drug addict, alcoholic, cross addicted, dope fiend, junkie, has not taken a first step. He says, as long as you identify by substances, you can put the blame on the substance. But when you identify as an addict, you're putting it on yourself because you suffer from the disease of addiction. And he told me never to identify again except as an addict. Not as a drug addict, but as an addict. Because I'm putting it on me. Because I am my disease. And he told me the first step was the things of my past. And the things of my past that I brought into recovery. The next 11 steps will become my future if I chose to use them. And he explained to me that when you surrender in the first step, it's a three-process deal. First you admit, and that's an easy thing for an addict to do. Many of us admitted we had a problem. He said, but after you admit, you must accept that you have the problem. That's hard for addicts. And then surrender to the process. And he said, when you do a first step, you can't stay on it for very long, that something would happen. And he explained it to me, it's like if you came out in the morning and you found a flat tire on your car, you have a choice of beating the car up and putting a brick through the windshield, or picking up the phone and calling the tow truck, or getting on a bus to get where you got to go. And he said, working a first step would be the responsible thing, to get an alternate form of transportation. And that's what we do with our addiction. We surrender to it. And he said, if I stay on that first step too long, it's like stripping myself naked and going out here on San Carlos Street at the train station. If I stand there naked too long, something's going to happen. And the second step was putting on new clothes. You see, what happens is I become powerless in the first step, but I gain power through the next 11 steps. Not power of my own, but the power of the steps. And it's a process. And in the second step where it talks about we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. They weren't talking about criminal insanity or clinical insanity. They're talking about the insanity of doing the same thing over and over again, but expecting different results. And I think we've all experienced that. And for me, it was even sicker because I would do the same thing over and over again, know what the results were going to be, and do it anyway. And I was told that the second step was talking about a power greater than self, wasn't talking about a higher power. I was told that in my addiction, I had a power greater than myself. How many mornings did I get up and say, I am not going to use today, and within 5 minutes, I was cooking up and shooting up. That's a power greater than myself. But it's a negative power greater than myself. In recovery, a power greater than itself could be anything that makes me aware of that insanity and wants to do it different. It can be something that a speaker shares, something that a sponsor shares, something you hear at a meeting, something you find in the literature, and even something that you may hear from an earth person. But something that makes you aware of that insanity before it happens. And he said to me, someday, Vito, even if you come to believe in a higher power, that higher power is not going to open the skies, send angels down, and fix me. That higher power is going to work through people, places, and things. And I would always find a power greater than myself in people, places, and things. And then when it was time to go on to the third step, I told my sponsor, we'll skip it and go to four. And he said, what do you mean we'll skip it? I said, you got to remember, I'm different. I'm unique. He said, how are you different and you unique? I said, because I'm not one of those God people. I'm an agnostic. And there was silence for a few moments. And then he said to me, he said, Vito, tell me why you're an agnostic and not an atheist. Now, nobody asked that question before, so I had to think for a few minutes. And I said, just in case someday I die, and I get up there or wherever, and there happens to be a God, I wanted him to know I wasn't one of them atheists. I just didn't know. And he said, Vito, typical addict, always got to have the back door. He said, I'm going to tell you something anyway. There's no such thing as an agnostic. All an agnostic is a chicken atheist. Now, can you imagine your sponsor calling you chicken? And then he further said, there's no such thing as an atheist. I said, what do you mean there's no such thing as an atheist? I know a few of them. He says, you ask anybody who says they're an atheist if they believe the sun's going to come up tomorrow morning. None of them will tell you that it's not going to come up. Says if you take a scale of 1 to 10, if you believe the sun's going to come up tomorrow morning and 10 is a God, it's all the same thing. It's just a matter of degrees. You believe and have faith in something. So I said, I can't do that third step. It's got that G-O-D word in it. He said, dummy, why don't you just change it to good orderly direction? You can have a higher power of any kind you want. And he said, the beauty of the third step is you can change your concept of a God anytime you want. And that has changed for me many times over the years. But in the third step, he introduced me something that I hated then, I hate today, and any newcomers that I sponsor hate it too. It's called writing. I inform my sponsor in my infinite wisdom that I don't need to write. I can talk and think. And he said, we'll see. He said, I want you to go out and buy a dictionary. Then I even got more insulted and said, I was born in this country. I can speak English. And he said, we'll see. So I go out and buy a 75-cent pocket dictionary. And I show him what I buy. And he says, get a real dictionary. I said, I can't do that. They cost money. He said, no, I want you to go out and buy a Merriam-Webster collegiate dictionary. You know, one of those that are yay thick. I said, well, those things cost about $25, which is like $150 today. He says, get it. Well, the obsession to use was being lifted over me, and I was afraid not to take direction, so I went out and bought this gigantic dictionary. And he said to me, I want you to look up the word decision, the word will, and the word lives. So I open up this dictionary, and I get to the word decision, and it's got like five definitions for one word. So I call my sponsor up. I said, I know why you got this thing with this Merriam-Webster guy. He was an addict, wasn't he? He gives you pick and choose. He said, dummy, go with your gut. And one of the meetings there was a starting place, a place to begin. That seemed to make sense with the step. Then I looked up the word lives, and I couldn't find it in this dictionary, so I called my sponsor and said, I got gypped. They left out a word. He said, dummy, look up the word life and you'll find it in the subheading. Sure enough, it was there with a bunch of definitions, but one of them said, things that occur in a lifetime. Now that seemed to make sense with the word, but I got a spiritual awakening when I looked up the word will. Because one of the definitions says your reaction to things that happen in your life. So I called my sponsor and said, I got this recovery stuff figured out. I go and I create all the garbage I want. I turn it to God and I create more garbage. He said, no, that's called confession at a Catholic church. He says the step does not say to turn it over. I said, what do you mean? I go to meetings, the people are saying, turn it over, turn it over. He says the step says turn it over to the Carib. I said, what's the difference, turn it over or turn it over to the Carib? He said, listen, dummy. If somebody was dumb enough to marry you, and then dumb enough to have a couple kids with you, and you wanted to go out on a date on a Friday night, and you called a babysitter, you wouldn't turn your kids to the babysitter. You would turn it over to the care of the babysitter to guide and watch in your absence. And that's what you're to do with your will and your life. Because your higher power does not want you to become a robot or a zombie, because the greatest gift you've got is your free will. And that seemed to make it okay. And I started to work these first three steps, and my life got better. But I wanted to be like the big shot in the program, because everybody who had did a fourth and fifth step back then was like they had arrived and they become recovered. So I used to say to my sponsor, don't you think we ought to put me on the fourth step? He said, you're too sick, dummy. Work the first three steps. And I didn't understand what he was saying. And he tried to tell me that the first three steps would keep me physically clean. It's a foundation. Steps 4 through 9 would keep me emotionally and spiritually clean, because he said it wasn't okay to be physically clean and spiritually dirty. And that steps 10 through 12 would be the maintenance and the growth steps. I would maintain what I had and grow on top of it. So I worked those first three steps in my life, and my life was getting better. And then finally, one day, my sponsor said, start the fourth step. 24 hours later, I called him and said, I'm done. He said, Vito, I told you in the past that if you want confession, I'll give you directions to the Catholic Church. He said, part of your fourth step is, yes, your history and your confession. But the step says a searching and fearless moral inventory. And this person that had the grasp of English says, what are morals? He said, look it up in the dictionary. And what he told me he wanted me to do was go into my addiction and write about it. Write about the things I had done in my addiction and how I felt about them when I was doing it. And he gave me topics like relationships and resentments and so forth. And he said, write to the best of your knowledge of how you felt about the things that you did when you were doing them. Then I want you to go back and write about the same things again, but write about how you feel about those things today. Because the first would tell me where you were, the second would tell you and me how much you've grown, and so in the fifth step, I'll know where to put you. And he explained to me that it was very necessary for us to write about how we feel about the things we did today, because it'll let us know that we're growing, and we need those pats in the back on this journey called recovery. And when it was finally time to go on to the fifth step, I made an appointment with my sponsor to meet in a place called Chula Vista, which is halfway between San Diego and Tijuana. And we sat on rocks. Today it's loaded with houses, but back then it was rolling desert. And we sat on rocks, and I had all this writing. And I expected my sponsor was going to be captive for the next 24 hours. And we sat out there on those rocks, and I started to read my fourth step. And he said, whoa, you were not reading any of it. And I got a resentment immediately, because I said to him, this is my history, this is my life. What did I write it for? And he said, you wrote it to introduce Vito to Vito. Remember those times you'd call me up and say, I cannot continue to write on this, I'll pick up and use. And I said, call the guys in your network. He said, because it was supposed to be how it makes you feel, because all that stuff's coming up. Now what I want you to do is glance at everything you wrote and let it come out of your gut. And a lot more came out of my gut than was on that paper. And I realize today the therapeutic value of that happening, of allowing to do all that writing and then share about the writing rather than reading it. And when it was all done, I looked for this big spiritual awakening that I heard other addicts say, like the city sanitation department came and carted it away. And the only damn thing I felt was I can go to a meeting and share I finished my fifth step. And I shared that with my sponsor, and he said, if most people are honest, the spiritual awakening of the fifth step comes in the weeks and the months after you do it. And I found that to be true, because my programs changed, my inner willingness changed. And isn't it funny how the sixth step follows the fifth step? we became entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. And this agnostic says to the sponsor, is this where you get on your knees and God takes it away? He says, you can if you want, but that's not what the step's talking about. He said, there's nowhere in the sixth step that it says God removes those defects of character. It says Vito became entirely ready to let the process begin. And I didn't understand what entirely ready meant, that willingness. And he said it's a preparation to have them removed. And he said what you've got to do is you take a piece of paper, draw a line down the center of it. On the one side of the line, you put all the defects and patterns that were identified in the fifth step. And on the other side of the line, just their opposites. This is where you're at, and this is where you need to go, and that's your roadmap to recovery. And then he explained to me the difference between a defect and a shortcoming. He said they're rooted in the same word, but there is a difference. The defects are part of me. They're part of my personality, part of my makeup. And the shortcoming is the acting out of it. It's like the sixth step would be packing the suitcase, and the sixth step would be taking the trip. So there was a difference. So I got busy, and I started writing them, and took the direction of my sponsor, because he said I needed to prioritize my defects in the order that they were giving me the most trouble. And I was supposed to work on one at a time and put the rest on the shelf. It's like taking a rifle and taking care of one at a time. If I tried to work on them all at once, it'd be a shotgun effect, and nothing would get done. And so I put them all on the shelf and worked one by one by one until they were entirely gone. But my sponsor forgot to tell me that when they're gone, we find a whole bunch of new ones for the rest of our life. If you think you're going to do a six and seven step one time, more will be revealed. And then when it was time to get to the seventh step, where we humbly ask them to remove these shortcomings, I said, is this where you get on your knees and God removes them? And his answer was the same. You get on your knees, there's nothing wrong. But that's not what the step's saying. I said, then what does the step say? He says, we humbly ask them. And for any addict to become humble is to own their stuff. You know, as addicts, we don't like doing that. We may say, well, I'm not always right, but I'm not wrong. Ask any of the female addicts. They hear it with their guys. And you begin to know when a male is beginning to recover because he starts owning some of his stuff. And you can tell when a female is beginning to work her seventh step, she stops owning his stuff. And you know, the seventh step was time for me to get a real wake-up that the steps, the process of the steps is like a chain link. One goes into the other. Because at that point in my recovery, I had a problem. I could not stay in a relationship because I had something called violent jealousy. A lot of the guys know what I'm talking about. Your hands start moving even before your mouth. And even female addicts only stay in that situation for so long. And he said to me, then what do you think I kept you on the first three steps for so long? He said, when you begin to feel that jealousy, you are not to deny it. You are not to fight it. You're to go to the first step and admit you're powerless over it and feel it. Feel it in every cell and fiber of your body. Feel yourself becoming totally unmanageable. Then go to a second step and see the insanity if you act out on those feelings. And then go to a third step and turn those feelings over to the care of the God of your understanding, asking you to give you the strength to do it different. And then go back to the second step and do it different. It was 1, 2, 3, 2. And I'd like to say it went away immediately, but it didn't. But I kept working those first three steps on each one of them. And I can tell you today, I have not had that problem for 36, 37, 38 years due to the steps. And I was told to work on each one of my shortcomings that way. And then it was time to move on to the eighth step. You know, we made a list and became willing to make amends to all those we had harmed. Well, I informed my sponsor, everybody owed me Christmas presents. It's an addict's attitude with the eighth step. And I said to him, when I become willing, I will make the list. He said, read the step, dummy. I picked the step up and said, we made a list and then became willing. So I said, okay, I'll make the list, but I'm not going to be willing. And you know, us addicts, we go from one extreme to another. I finished the list and I want to go out and make amends to the whole world. And he said, whoa. That's why we do a ninth step with a sponsor. That's why we do a ninth step with somebody who has more experience than us. And he said to me, the way the step says, we made direct amends to all those we had harmed, except when to do so would injure them or others. And he explained to me, sometimes you cannot make direct amends. You cannot go to a grandmother and say, by the way, do you remember 10 years ago when your wedding band and diamond was missing? Guess who? You would cause more problems than in the first place. But those amends need to be made through your higher power. And my sponsor went through that list, and everyone that he felt that a direct amend should be made, he said, you go do it. It was his direction, not mine. And then there was those faceless people, and we've all had them in our life, like two ships passing in the night. Don't remember who they are, their names, or anything, but those amends need to be made too. And we make them through our higher power. And if our higher power feels we need to make direct amends to them, guess what? They will show up in your life. Sometimes as much as 15 years later. And when they're there, you know why they're there. Because there's no coincidence on this journey called recovery. And then he said to me, the end of the step, injure them or others. He said why the word others was in there. Because I didn't come into recovery to injure myself. I'm not going to walk into the 48th precinct in the Bronx and say, by the way, do you remember in 1956 there was a gang rumble? Somebody might have got killed. Do you happen to have any unsolved murders? That's insanity. But you need to go through your higher power. If you think there's something there, you need to give it up through your higher power. You didn't come to put yourself in a bad position. But you got to have the contrition and the remorse. And that was the end of the steps 4 through 9. That was the cleaning house spiritually and emotionally and mentally. And then we have to maintain what we got through the first 9. The 10th step talked about personal inventory. Said we made a list of when we were wrong and promptly admitted it. And I said to my sponsor, I know how to say I'm sorry. He says, yes, you suffer from sorry-itis. And many of us do, and our families tell us we're a sorry thing of a person. He says, it's okay to apologize, but for you, I don't want you to use the word I'm sorry. And it was blended into my head, stop saying it, because it came out so natural. And he said, what this says when it says promptly admit it, it's not talking about apologies, it's talking about self-honesty. When I make a list and see when I was wrong, I promptly admit it to me, so tomorrow I don't make the same mistake over again. You see, in recovery, it's okay to make mistakes, but it's not okay to continually make the same mistake over and over and over. And see, that's the beauty of the 10th step. By sitting down every day and writing about your day and reflecting on it, and when you were wrong, promptly admit it, you know what step to take the elevator down to work. It gives you a barometer of what you need to do. And I think I did a written 10th step for at least 15, 18 years. I don't do it today, but I do a mental 10th step every night because I was so much in the habit of doing it. And then it was time to go on to the 11th step, which I believe, and this, of course, everything I share here tonight is my experience and my opinion. I cannot share anybody else's experience. But I believe the 11th step is a keystone to recovery, because it says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. And that word, we understood Him, is in there the same as in the 3rd step. The 3rd step doesn't say God as we understand Him. It says God as we understood it, stood Him. And that was put in for a specific reason. Because when a person walks in this room, they have a God of their own understanding. And if the step said God as we understand it, would mean Narcotics Anonymous would have a higher power of its understanding. And we don't. We give the individual the right to their own higher power. So in the 11th step, it says, God as we understood him also. But the key to that step, it says, we sought, which means in recovery we're seekers. We're spiritual seekers. We sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. And a lot of people get very offended with the word God in Narcotics Anonymous. And I don't know how you can get offended when you've got steps to say we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. But it doesn't tell us how to pray or meditate. It gives us our individual freedom to do it in our own way. We don't adopt outside ways. We may go other places to learn techniques, but that's to improve our personal experience. We do not ever tell another addict how to pray or meditate. We share our experience. And there was once a writer that wrote, if you don't go within, you go without. And that's why meditation is so important. You see, any day that I do not do my meditation, I go without that day. And meditation is not reading just for today book. That's a written meditation, and then when you read it, you're supposed to contemplate on it. That's one form of meditation. So just do the reading is not meditating. To do quiet time is meditating. To reflect on what you read or reflect upon your life. And then that step says we thought to prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us. And I've been to many conventions where addicts would stay up all night and do something called mental masturbation by saying, what is God's will? And discuss it like medieval philosophers. And I've come to a simple conclusion. God's will for me today, tomorrow, and forever would be the highest good for everybody concerned in any situation. And my sponsor said, what I have to do is step outside the situation and look at it as an observer. What is the best thing for everybody involved, not what's the best thing for Vito. And that will always be God's will. But the hard part of that step is praying for the power to carry it out. Because as addicts, we know what's right, but it's hard as hell to do it. And that's why the 11th step becomes so important. Is we discover what God's will for us is in those situations and then pray like hell that we have the power to follow through on that. And when we finally get to the 12th step is the portal to life. Because it says as a result of these steps, it's talking about the previous 11. We had a spiritual awakening. And for me, I believe that spiritual awakening is that these steps work. These steps are the answer to any life's problem. And I know people will stop here and say, well, how's it going to help a job situation? How's it going to help a broken relationship? How's it going to help a financial relationship? The way the steps will help all those things is it will let you work through the situation and come out the other side without using. And that's why the steps are the answer. And it tells us, we had that spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and we tried to carry this message to other addicts. What's the message we carry? The message of the 12 steps. That they work. It is a solution to recover. As it says in How It Works, these are the principles that enable us to recover. And then it says we practice them in all our affairs. It's a lifelong thing. There's days my recovery are so good, and there's days a newcomer walks a better path than me. That's why we keep practicing them. You know, and I remember when I got through these steps and worked them, I married a girl at that time whose family came over on the Mayflower. She used to quote herself as being blue blood. And she would say to me, like, what do you need to go to those meetings with those people? You're not like that anymore. We have the house and the big car and all the goodies. If you want to go to meetings, why don't you go to the Rotary Club? But you start talking to an addict like that, you're in enemy territory. And we see it all the time. You come back to one meeting a week, one meeting a month, show up once every 6 months, and then the ultimate insult when you become an NAC. You show up once a year to pick up a medallion. Say, hey, peons, keep coming back. You could do it too. And that's what an N.A. thief is. They got a life as a result of this program. And they're not here to give it back. And I became an N.A. thief. I start showing up once a year to pick up my medallion. But what happened is what everybody told me would happen. The crisis would come. And you know, the phone numbers were no longer good. The phone weighed 2 million pounds like a newcomer. And the day came when the Pied Piper was outside my window. And I knew if I left that house, I would pick up and die. And my ego was too big to pick up a phone because I hadn't talked to another addict on the phone for 7-8 months. And I said, I have the tools. I can do it by willpower. If I can make it till the sun comes up, I'll be okay. Try willpower with a pack of X-Lax. And the sun came up in the morning, and that damn Pied Piper was still there. And I said, rather than go out and use, I'll take an easier, softer way. I tied a rope around my neck and jumped off a chair. But being an addict, we get things backwards. The weight of my body swung, broke the door down. The girl I was married to cut the rope, called the paramedic. They came with the paddle, revived me, took me to the emergency room. The emergency room doctor said, well, you know, he tried to take his own life. He's got to go to Cuckoo Farm. So they sent me up to the 7th floor to the mental ward. And the psychiatrist was doing the intake there to evaluate me. And she was a female that we sat and talked for about a half hour. And thank God she had an idea what the disease of addiction was. Because she said, Vito, you're a little cuckoo like most people. Your biggest problem is you're an addict without a program. If I don't commit you, you promise to get your butt to a meeting. And when I ran to that meeting that day, my first sponsor's words were echoing in my head. When you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you begin to rot. And I had become ripe. And I found out that recovery is a participating event, not a spectator event. We must get involved. We must sponsor. We must do service. And obviously that marriage couldn't go on. But being an addict in the rooms, I found another woman. And I got to tell on myself, she was a newcomer. But I justified it. I said she wasn't really a newcomer. She was a rethread. Because she's been back in and out for 5 years. So she's not really a newcomer. I mean, after all, I knew her for 5 years in the rooms. And most of the time, that ends in disaster. Fortunately for me, she got the program, and we got married, and we had 20 good years together before she passed away. You know, she had a very good program, and we did a thing all through our marriage. We took every Sunday, when we were living up in the Pocono Mountains in Pennsylvania, we used to go to the Jersey Shore every Sunday. We'd walk 10 miles down the beach and 10 miles up. No cell phones, beepers, or anything. The quality time to discuss our relationship. And then one day, she couldn't walk no more. And she went to the doctors and they diagnosed her in stage 4 lung cancer because she had another addiction called nicotine. And they told her she had 6 months to live. And so she opted for some experimental chemo, and we figured we'd beat this thing. I mean, after all, we had higher power, and we had people in the program all over the world that would pray for us. And I remember it was a Thursday morning, her oncologist wanted her to go to the Carolina Medical Center. We were living in Charlotte, North Carolina at that time, and get some x-rays of her lungs and carry them across the street. And we did that, and we carried the pictures over. He looked at me and said, I got some good news for you. The tumors are shrinking. So we went out that afternoon, and we had dinner. We celebrated, and we got home, and Thursday night was my home group. And she said to me, I'm going to kick back tonight and just watch some TV. You go to the meeting, and I'll see you later. And she put her arms around me and really hugged me, and she said, V, I want you to know I really love you. Hear what I'm saying. I really love you. I said, I love you too, Patty, and off to the meeting I went. This was about 7 o'clock, about 9:30, I'm coming home, and we had these little French windows along the front door. And my wife, in her older age, she got an empty nest syndrome, and she started adopting toy poodles, and she had 7 toy poodles. And I look in the window and I see these toy poodles in a circle like wolves and her legs sticking straight up in the air. And I open the door and I go in there and I see her laying on the floor and her eyes bugged out. So I grab a washcloth and I wipe her face and try to revive her, and I couldn't. And I called 911. The ambulance came. They took her away. And I locked the dogs up, got in my car, and I followed her to the emergency room. And when I got there, there were people from the program that got there before me. And the doctor came out and said, look, we don't know what's wrong yet. We're trying to stabilize her. We'll let you know as soon as we know something. About 1 o'clock in the morning, the doctor comes out and says, I want to talk to you in the family room. I knew something was wrong. And we get in there, and he says, look, I want to let you know what happened. The cancer spread. It metastasized, went to her brain. There was a tumor on her brain. It popped, and her brain stem was snapped, and she's clinically dead. She's only alive on life support system. I recommend you disconnect her and let her go in peace. And I picked that doctor up, and I threw him against the wall and said, listen, you're talking about my best friend, my wife, my lover. Fix her. And, of course, they called security and got me out of the hospital. And I went home, and I laid down with the dogs for a while. And a couple hours later, I went back to the hospital. By that time, she was in intensive care. And I'd walk in once an hour when they let me in, hold her hand, and say, Patty, if you got to go, go, but I can't do it. This went on all the way to 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And all of a sudden, the light bulb went off. I haven't stopped to pray. I haven't stopped to do anything except feel sorry for myself. So I went out into the meditation garden in the hospital, and I sat there, and I got quiet. And a little vision popped in my head of when we were living in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. We had the same home group on Monday night. We would go there in the same car, and the meeting was over. She wanted to get home and watch TV, and I'm like the guy. I stop every 2 seconds to bull. And she would give me these looks like, let me even get the F out of here. And I seen that picture in my head, and that was the same look she had in the hospital bed. And I knew it was time to let her go. So I went to the nurse's station. And I said, I'm ready to sign the papers. They said, fine, you need the doctor to come in to do it. He came in, released her, and within 2 minutes she died with a smile on her face. And it was over. And I was angry at God, angry at Narcotics Anonymous, angry at recovery. I remember I was driving a little sports car, and I got to the first traffic light outside the hospital, and I just banged my fist into the steering wheel, and out comes the airbag, and throwing it on the street. And I got home, and I ripped the phone off the wall, locked the doors, didn't want to hear anything from you people. I got up the next morning, and I had to take her clothes to the funeral parlor, buy the casket. She wanted to be buried above ground, so I had to go out and purchase a mausoleum. And by the time I got home, you folks broke into my house, had food and coffee there. And I came in, and I said, I didn't want you there. And they said, we're not here for you. She was our friend. So I said, fine, stay the weekend. But as soon as she's buried, I'm going to go out and get high. They said, you do what you want. We're here for her. And the weekend came and the funeral went. And they all left, except I had some sponsees that came out of town. And they said, they're staying the week. So I said, fine, you could stay the week. Don't talk this meeting shit with me. And I don't want to hear nothing about recovery. They said, fine, we're just staying. Keep you company. Well, finally, Thursday came, and they were leaving the next day. And one says to me, Vito, do you remember what you tell everybody just before they want to go out and relapse? Well, this is the trouble with having sponsees that know you so well. Because I had this deal that when one of my sponsees would come up to me and say, I'm sick of recovery, I want to go out and relapse, I would say to them, you got my blessing. You just got to do one thing before you relapse. Do a 90 and 90. When that's done, then you can tell everybody Vito said it's okay. Now, you wouldn't do anything less than you asked somebody else to do. That's when your sponsees know you so well, they have to use your own stuff on you. Said, okay, I'll do a 90 and 90 to prove that this program don't work anymore. And I did like 120 meetings in 45 days. And I woke up one morning and a voice sort of reverberated inside my head, said, you stupid fool. I gave you 20 years of a good relationship. Some people don't get one day. Who the hell are you to be ungrateful? And my gratitude turned to, I mean, my grief turned to gratitude almost instantly. And the reason I tell you that, if I didn't do what newcomers do, I wouldn't be here. The miracle wouldn't happen. What works for a newcomer works for an old timer. You know, we seem to have a class system in this fellowship, which I can't stand. Somebody with time shares something at a meeting, and they're hurting, and people say, well, how can he share something like that with the time he got? Well, the reason they can share that is because they're an addict and they're hurting. And they need people to stand up and give them a loving hug and say, we understand. And they'll say, well, you can't show a newcomer that with that amount of time you hurt. Yes, you can, because recovery is about living life on life's terms. And if you've got old-timers that are hurting, be there for them. Their life depends on it. What do you think we have so many people leave this fellowship? Because they don't feel they can be honest to share anymore because people tell them, how could you share that with your time? They are human beings and they're addicts. And a newcomer's blood is red and so is an old-timer. And we die equally. I'm going to finish with two things. I want to talk about our basic text. When you open it up, you'll see a whole bunch of italicized writing in there. And that is the only remembrance we have to the man who founded this fellowship and gave his life. That writing is the writing of Jimmy Kennan. He started this fellowship in 1953 with a couple other addicts. By 1959, he was the only member left. And then in 1960, the fellowship had new people coming in, and they adopted the traditions and a board of trustees. It was people like Chuck Skinner came in, and Bob Barrett, and Sylvia, who later came up to the Bay with her and her brothers and started most of the meetings up here. Those people, and Peppy, they got this fellowship going, the new NA, and it's the reason for them that we're here today. And Jimmy would finance his own house to buy literature and send out starter kits all over the country. And he is truly the founder of this fellowship. But we forget about him. And more conventions are giving out the bumper stickers, I'm a friend of Jimmy K. Because we need to remember the man who started this thing, and because of him, we're alive today. And I'm going to end with a story. There was an addict by the name of Joe Addict. And he was walking down the street and fell into an open manhole cover. And he was screaming and hollering that he was dying from the disease of addiction, that the dragons of hell were on his butt, and there was no hope for him. And he just wanted death rather than to live in this disease. And there was a minister walking down the street who heard the screams, and he stopped. And he said, what's going on down there? And a voice came up and said, I'm Joe Addict, and I'm dying of the disease of addiction, and there is no hope, and the dragons of hell are tearing me apart. The minister said, there's no problem. He pulled out a Bible, prayed over him, said, you're going to be okay, son, and went on his way. But Joe Addict wasn't okay. He was still dying and horrified and screaming. And a doctor comes down the street, and he stops at the manhole, and he says, what's going on down there? And Joe said, I'm Joe Addict. And I'm dying from the disease of addiction. And there's no hope. And I'd rather be dead than live in this pain and misery. Doctor said, no problem. He took out a prescription pad, dropped a couple scripts down there, said, get them filled. You'll be okay. But Joe wasn't okay. And he kept screaming. And then there was this little thin man who was born in Scotland, who migrated to Philadelphia and then to Burbank, California. And his name was Jimmy K., Jimmy Kennan. And he come walking down the street, and he heard the pleas. And he said, what's going on down there? And Joe said, I'm Joe Addict, and I'm dying from this disease, and there's no way out, and I'd rather be dead. And Jimmy jumped down into that manhole, and Joe said to him, what are you doing here? Are you crazy? There's no way out. And Jimmy said, I've been here before, and I know the way out. Thanks for letting me share.